Reminders. I think we're ready to get started. So I'm going to ask our support staff to go ahead and start sharing their screen to call up the formal presentation materials. And then I'll ask Daniel to go ahead and come back on camera so that we can get things started today. So as Daniel's coming back on camera, I will go ahead and make sure that we can look at him. Daniel, you look great. I can see the slides. So Daniel, let me turn it over to you.
Thank you, Jean. And hello to all our participants. Thank you guys so much for joining us today. On behalf of EPA's Office of Brownfields and Land Revitalization, I would like to welcome you to the kickoff webinar for EPA's Redevelopment Academy three-part series. This is the 2021 edition. And the series is based on the unique challenges and opportunities in formal industrial and brownfield sites, in particular, the different physical, environmental, and market challenges associated with these sites. So, starting today and continuing during the two additional webinars planned for October and November, we're going to be learning how communities can reposition their brownfield and other contaminated sites by managing the risks that prevent site reuse opportunities. So, we will discuss cutting-edge redevelopment practices at some of the toughest sites in the country while emphasizing solutions and success stories. We will share the foundations of real estate development, finance, and how to successfully integrate cleanup and redevelopment. So I encourage you to attend all three webinars. For those of you who attend all three webinars, you will receive a certificate of completion for EPA's Redevelopment Academy. And keep in mind that all of those recordings of these webinars will be available on EPA's cluin.org website. And I also want to give a quick reminder for those of you who can join us for the upcoming National Brownfields Conference in Oklahoma City this year. Please be sure to sign up for the free follow-on workshop on December 8th, which is going to be part of this year's what we're calling Brownfields University. And that workshop will focus on how to get the tough deals done by bringing together the many factors involved in contaminated site cleanup and redevelopment. So I hope you guys will check that out. And now, if you guys, or if any of you were able to join us for the 2019 Redevelopment Academy webinar series, you might remember that we focused on how developers approach contaminated site redevelopment, and you will recognize several of the real estate concepts and terms. This time, however, we're going to focus on specific actions that communities can take to move their properties into redevelopment. That being said, a lot of the concepts are the same. So if you missed the 2019 webinar series, that is not a problem. Again, each webinar is archived on EPA's cluin.org website. So EPA is hosting this webinar series to support community-led efforts to reuse contaminated or formerly contaminated sites in innovative, equitable, and sustainable ways. We know that communities often struggle with site redevelopment, and one of our goals is to encourage and assist communities by explaining how site assessment and cleanup relates directly to redevelopment opportunities, and also introduce types of expertise and partnerships that are often needed to bring about land revitalization. And EPA has many guides and publications on our Land Revitalization Toolkit website, so I invite you to use them as you get started on brownfields reuse in your community. So be sure to check out our Anatomy of a Brownfields Redevelopment, Community Actions that Drive Brownfields Redevelopment, and we'll soon be releasing our Revitalization Ready Guidebook, a guide for revitalizing land in your community and creating a brownfields investment package. So please be sure to check those out on our website. All of that being said, I will now introduce our expert speakers for this webinar series. They are from Vida Nova, a national consultancy that specializes in site repositioning, particularly for complex sites with minimal face value. They work to create value and develop approaches for long-term sustainable outcomes at these types of sites across the country. And as a long-term member of EPA's Land Revitalization Technical Assistance Team, for many years, Vida Nova has worked directly with communities, big and small, to help them identify local assets, create market opportunities, and remove barriers to redevelopment. So at this point,
Daniel, I'm actually going to interject here because I think we have an engagement opportunity for the audience. And I want to do that before we move on. So I'm going to go ahead and launch one more poll on the screen. So if you were here earlier, this is going to be a repeat, but it's a different question. For those of you who didn't join us earlier, I'm going to go ahead and pop up a new window. So there should be a new poll question that's now floating in the middle of your screen asking what best describes your profession. You'll see a series of options and you can simply click on the one and that best applies to you and then hit the submit button. If you have many people at your location, you'll just have to negotiate amongst yourselves the best common response for all of you and then send that on in. And then in just a moment, I'll go ahead and close this out and share those results so we can get a sense of who's virtually joining us on the session today. I want to be sure that both our presenters, our organizers, as well as the live audience gets a sense of who's making up our class today. So it looks like those responses are starting to slow down. So I'm going to go ahead and end this poll right now and let's share those results. And so it does appear as though state, local, or tribal governments are making up about a third of the attendees. We also have a number of economic development professionals, environmental consultants, some planners on, as well as federal attendees, and then some others who are joining us. So I want to thank everybody for chiming in and sharing that information. All right, Daniel, with that, I'll go ahead and close those poll results and send it back to you.
Great. Thank you, Jean. So now at this point, I'll turn things over to Michael Taylor, Elaine Richardson, and Patrick Rowe from Vita Nova to get us started. Thank you.
Great. Great. Thanks, Daniel. It's great to be back again. for those who were involved, we ran the series in 2019 and then did a workshop at the LA Brownfield Conference. We're essentially repeating that. However, the information will be somewhat different. We sort of think about this as sort of a 200 level course, if you will. We'll cover some of the same things, but we hope to up our game a little bit. So if you like what you see, please tell your friends. This will be recorded and there will be a certificate at the end. What I would say about that is over the past couple of years, we've seen a number of people have put their certificates on LinkedIn. It is a great way to get information about brownfields that you're really not going to get anywhere else. You know, I'm a certified planner. There really aren't a lot of brownfield courses in APA. There's not a lot in the economic development profession. So we try to combine our knowledge of real estate, environmental issues, planning, economic development, focus on those really tough sites that are sitting around that you would love to see redeveloped. But the problem is, a developer is just not going to come in and deal with all the issues up front. And so this series is really about how do you tap that value that is latent in your community. And with all the development pressure, both for housing, for logistics, for other types of development going on around the country, you just can't wait to start that process. So we're very excited to be here. Elaine Richardson is back. Pat is has been involved with us for a long time. I don't think was involved in 2019, but we've got a great mix of talent. Elaine has a private sector background, has been involved in the real estate business for a long time. And so we'll share a lot of the perspective of developers and what they need to see. Pat has a public and private background, having worked for the city of Fort Collins for a number of years in real estate and planning. So I think we've got a really good mix today. We're really excited to get going, and we hope we're going to have a lot to share with you that you can use in the future. And as Dan mentioned, and I don't want to skip over it, we've worked now for year and a half, maybe 2 years on this revitalization ready guide. It will be coming out on the website. It will be made available certainly by the Brownfields Conference, if not before, but that's almost a roadmap for a lot of the things that we're going to talk about today. So next slide. Just a little bit on the course objectives. You will get some basic understanding of some of the real estate development processes and factors that affect its success. There'll be a little bit of what we presented in 2019 just to get us going. And then we really want to give you the tools to address a lot of these issues, give you ideas and tools for dealing with the constraints that hold redevelopment back. And then to the extent we can, we want to enhance your leadership and decision-making skills in this process through these webinars, but also what will be coming out with the Revitalization Ready Guide are actually worksheets that you can use as you make these decisions on your sites in your communities. With that, I'll turn it over to Elaine. Elaine, thank you for taking the time today. I think everybody's really excited to hear what you and Pat have to say.
Great. Well, thank you, everyone. And it's a pleasure to be back here. For those of you that were part of the 2019 program, we're going to do a little bit of a refresher. For those of you who have not been part of these programs in the past, these webinars, we're going to teach you a little bit about development, the redevelopment process, who developers are, what they do, why they do it, how they make money. We'll spend a little bit of time on that. And then Pat will come in and talk a little bit about how to remove those barriers for redevelopment, those things that developers can't do and still be profitable. And from there, we're going to end up talking about a case study, which shows a city that really had a very complex situation in their downtown and how they accomplished a redevelopment that's pretty substantial over a 20-year period by slowly removing those barriers. So we'll start off today with a little refresher. And Abe, next slide. So let's start with, why do we even want to do this? Why? What are the reasons for redeveloping brownfields? Well, I think the obvious reason is none of us want underutilized derelict buildings or properties in our communities. But it's a little bit more than that. Because even if you were to get the funding to just clean up a property, that may not be enough. Redevelopment ensures the long-term protectiveness of a cleanup by utilizing that property in an appropriate manner. We want to get beyond just putting up a fence and saying, hey, we took care of this official risk. We want to put this back into productive use. But redevelopment is also a funding source for some of those long-term costs that may exist. So if you have a property that might need to do some long-term monitoring, the redevelopment could be a way to pay for long-term groundwater monitoring that's in a position to be reused. And integration of cleanup and the redevelopment is a way to actually save money overall. If you need to build an access road in order to clean up the property, and you need an access road for redevelopment, and you can put that in the same spot, you don't need to do it twice. And so being able to integrate those activities in the long run is a way to be able to save money and get more done with the dollars that you're able to combine and accomplish. Next, Abe. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the stages of development, because it's important to understand what a developer goes through, the process, and why they do the things that they do, and what they're doing at each stage. So you can understand how you, especially at the state and local level, how you can help developers understand the situation and be more successful. So there's four key stages: pre-development, deal management, site preparation and development, and then property management. We're going to talk a little bit about all of these over the next couple of slides, but let me just talk a minute about each one. So in the pre-development stage, this is when a developer is trying to decide if they're even interested in the property. They're going to do a feasibility analysis, and if the feasibility analysis says, yes, this has potential, then they'll do more detailed due diligence. If that plays out well and they want to move forward, then they'll get into the details of the deal itself. What are the actual dollars? How will they get the funding? Who will be part of the final team? Some of those things are not decided until they've actually done that feasibility analysis, because they don't want to spend a lot of money up front only to find out that the property isn't worthwhile or doesn't meet their criteria or doesn't fit their typical operating approach. So it's really important, and we're going to spend a lot of time today talking about that pre-development feasibility analysis step, because that's really when a developer makes a core decision. Assuming a deal is done, they'll get into site preparation and zoning and all the actual development. And ultimately, when a development is built, then they're in either the property management stage where they own the property, or they're going to flip it. They're going to sell it to somebody else to do that property management work. And that new owner will become the property manager. Next. So in the pre-development stage, the first thing that a developer needs to do is try and visualize the opportunity. Different developers will have very different ideas for the same property because they all focus and specialize in different types of developments. You might have a residential developer, you might have an industrial developer. We'll talk a little bit about developers that build and developers that prepare land, get into some of those details in a minute. But redevelopment ideas are really based upon a developer's market focus. And developers focus for a reason. They know how to make money in a particular market. Why does that matter to you? That's because if you're trying to attract somebody to your downtown to do residential infill development or new mixed-use housing, there's no reason to waste time talking to an industrial developer that only does warehouses. You want to use your resources appropriately and effectively. And so it's good to understand and ask the questions of developers in terms of what their focus is. And developers will specifically look for current zoning that matches what their interests are. So if you're looking for residential development in a particular area, but your zoning doesn't necessarily allow it, or in more often what we're seeing these days is that mixed use, some retail or an office on first floor and apartments upstairs, a lot of zoning actually doesn't allow for that. And even though that might be the community's goals, the whole land use process is not aligned with that. So you need to make sure that all of that's aligned. The second thing just to keep in mind is that developers all have very specific goals and objectives. They make money at different points in the process. Some developers make money by doing the cleanup. Some developers make money by preparing the land. Some do it, they make their money by building the building and then flipping it. And others actually make money at the very end by being the landlord. So different developers will be interested in different sites based upon how they make their money. Next. So when a developer is evaluating the potential of a property, they will look at risk versus reward. They want to do a feasibility study upfront using available information to understand what the risks might be, what the timing might be, and how can they actually make this project work? In the upfront analysis, they don't want to spend a lot of money. They may look, developers may look at 10 sites and 10 opportunities a month. And so they don't want to spend a lot of money on a property that they're going to walk away from. So it's very critical that communities have as much information about their brownfields properties publicly available on the internet, because many of these developers don't travel until they're interested, and that people can find and investigate properties and opportunities from their desktop. Next. Assuming that a developer wants to move forward with a development, then they next go to negotiating a deal. Now, this can be very different if it's a property that is owned or controlled by a municipality, or one that perhaps is in tax arrears, or perhaps it's privately owned. So that whole negotiating process can be very different depending on who the owner or controlling entity is. But so essentially what's going to happen is that the developer has to negotiate the deal and make that decision. Is it a go or isn't it a go? Because now they're starting to spend money. They're going to start spending money to go after entitlements, meaning zoning approvals, permitting, any other regulatory approvals for the cleanup. And then they're going to need to secure financing and insurance. And ultimately, they don't want to spend that money unless they know they can be successful. So that go, no decision is all about their resources and their funding availability. Next. So let's talk for a minute about development and developers' different approaches. So first off, there's basically three types of developers. There's developers who prepare the land. They might do the environmental cleanup. They might do the site preparation, put in the infrastructure, topographically grade it appropriately for reuse, worry about stormwater management, all of those things. And then they sell it or transfer it or have a deal with a vertical developer. And a vertical developer comes in and then builds the building. Now, some developers do both, but not all do. And when a community is talking to developers, it's good to ask the question, because if you're only talking to a land developer and they don't have a vertical developer as a partner or identified, then you really don't know what the final use of that property is going to be. So it's really important to ask those questions. What's their specialty? Do they do both? Are they just doing the land? Understand those. And then there's redevelopment developers. Those are people that focus on renovations, retrofitting of existing buildings and properties, and even entire inner city and urban blocks. So redevelopment is a little bit different than your typical developer that does vertical. There's a specialty, and there are those that are really good at renovations and redevelopment that are different than those that are good at vertical development. And obviously, we talked a minute ago about the types of development: residential, retail, office, industrial, mixed use. Some developers do all, but very few developers do all types. Most of them will focus or specialize in one or two of these different types of developments. It might be residential and mixed use. It might be office retail and other type of commercials, such as hotels, hospitalities, that sort of thing. And then in industrial and logistics. So again, as I mentioned earlier, if you're looking for a very particular type of development in your community, it's important to try and reach out and attract the right type of developer for that. Next. And this just gives you the, you know, a little bit more detail on the developers and developments. So within the sectors, let's take industrial, for instance. Within the sector of industrial and logistics, energy is a subsection of industrial, and that might be solar, it might be power plants, it might be different types of energy combinations. And they're a subsection, and they are truly a specialty. Warehouse and distribution, there's a big difference between building a 10,000 square foot warehouse that might be used by a local contractor and building a $1.5 million warehouse for Amazon. The same companies don't necessarily do the same type of work. And so it's very important to understand what their capabilities are and their experience. And you really want to be asking developers about their experience and their credentials. Office, same thing. There's a big difference between building a 30-story office tower in a major city than there is building a suburban office complex that's going to be sprawling across 2 to 3 acres. Takes a different type of skill set, different type of attracting different type of users, end users for that building. Retail, residential, again, they're pretty obvious here that there can be very differences of residential, suburban, neighborhood of 30 houses, single family is very different than infill housing in a small to moderate city. So look for those differences in your developers. Next. So I'm going to take a couple of minutes to just talk about end user site selection, because we have found that many communities think about who they want to have occupy a particular site or a particular property or a particular building, rather than the land use itself. And there's a little bit of caution to that, because if you're really targeting a very specific type of end user, a particular name, it brings a whole slew of different complexities to the project. And so we want to spend a couple of minutes explaining how site selection is done. So site selection is when a large corporation or a chain select a site for a new development. It could be a pharmacy, it could be a convenience store, it could be a gym, and we'll talk a little bit about some of those things. But it's important to understand that site selection is extremely criteria-based. It really doesn't matter if you're the best community out there and the most wonderful place to live. If the numbers don't work, then the end user probably won't ever consider coming. So what is site selection professionals? And there is a segment of this industry that just does site selection for major corporations. What do they look at? Well, they look at time. They're all under a significant time crunch. That's why these companies use specialized people to do this work and to find their sites. They're on very specific budgets. They know exactly how they build their buildings because most of them are the same no matter where they go, and they know how much they want to spend. They have very specific criteria to meet, and I'm going to show you in a minute what some of that criteria would be. And then they have business objectives that they must meet. 80% of a site selection decision is made from a desktop before anybody even knows that a company is looking to place one of their businesses in a location. So if somebody's looking for, you know, for instance, to put in a pharmacy and they're looking in North Carolina, they may have a county that they want to be located in, but they're going to make that decision and narrow it down to available sites before anyone in that county or anyone in that state knows about it or before they've talked to the economic development people. So it's really important to understand how your online presence really makes a difference in how successful redevelopment can be. Next slide. I'm not going to go through all these details. You will have access to all of this online, and the slides will be available online. But the purpose I want to say here is that every type of site selection has very specific criteria. So for instance, a convenience store is looking at needing approximately 3,000 square feet. But most important is they need 25,000 vehicles a day passing that location. So if you don't have that number on the street where your site is located, they're not going to look. It doesn't mean you can't have a convenience store in a smaller rural community. It just means that that might have to come from inside the entrepreneurial spirit of your own community members rather than looking to a national chain to come into your community. It can be done. It's just not going to be done by a national chain. And that's still the same thing is true when you get to urgent care or discount grocery store or whatnot, is there's very specific guidelines. When you have a fitness center, for instance, they're looking for a population of 25,000 people within a 5 mile of a location, and they want it skewed towards female because I was surprised to learn this, but more female go to gyms than males. And that's very important for these national chains like Planet Fitness and some of the other chains. Does that mean you can't have a fitness center in a smaller community? Absolutely not. It just means it might be something where it's smaller classes held in a community center or something that is more grown from the inside rather than trying to attract a national chain. Next. So if you are trying to attract a corporate end user or a large chain, how do you do that? most important is make information publicly available. Many states have state and regional websites for available properties for redevelopment. Make sure your brownfields are on those databases. That is exactly where every site selector starts, and they start there for looking not only just about the site and the size and the location, but make sure the demographic information that is supporting that site is all up to date and accurate. So much of a corporate end user and a national chain's decision-making is based upon workforce. We all know today under COVID, it's really tough to get employees, and that's been a real issue with our economy and is constraining it in many cases. So making decisions based upon demographics and the workforce size is critically important. Many of the databases that are out there right now are based upon the 2010 census. The 2020 census data is available out there. You know, it's being released slowly, but they're not necessarily connecting there, and there's not a lot of resources to do that. But it may be useful for your own community to create a fact sheet about your site that has some of that more up-to-date information. And anything you can do to make your properties shovel-ready, meaning that you've overcome some of the constraints, and Patrick's going to talk about how to do some of that, is really helpful. And the next one. And there's one more slide. I'm going to talk a minute about attracting developers in all types of markets, and then we'll take some questions. But there's really four tiers of real estate markets in the United States, but really this applies worldwide. There's the first tier real estate market. That's New York City, Seattle, Los Angeles, those really big cities. They're active markets, challenged right now as many workers moved out of the cities to under the COVID scenarios, and a lot of companies are still working remotely. So there's a lot of vacancy right now, but they're generally active markets, and development there can generally be done with private financing. They don't need to get public financing. Second tier real estate markets, which are more like Buffalo, Cleveland, Indianapolis, are also active real estate markets. There are things going on, most of it focused on the downtown and some industrial logistics expansion as Amazon and other companies, you know, are trying to set up their whole distribution networks. But these often need help from the public sector, creation of public-private partnerships to fund it and to fund the infrastructure that's needed. And that's really what we want to talk to you about today, is how can you get some of these infrastructure and other constraints resolved in order to make it financially feasible for these to be built. Third tier real estate markets, more like a Gary, Indiana, a Meriden, Connecticut, which is the case study we're going to talk about later on today. You know, many of those communities don't have significant development in their downtown without some significant public investment that creates the momentum to be successful. And one of the reasons we want to show you Meriden is to show you that it can be done. And finally, we have the fourth tier, which is rural communities. And rural communities have their own set of challenges in terms of trying to grow from within and creating their own sense of personality and creating a destination for their own community so that they can build their own brand of economic development. So that kind of gives you an overview, a refresher of redevelopment. We'll take a couple of questions before Patrick gets into actually how to reposition for redevelopment.
Yeah, so it looks like there was one question that I wanted to answer out loud. It was, can EPA verify whether or not a property is safe to redevelop? And I can answer that. The answer is yes. And EPA does provide brownfields assessment grants to assess or characterize the environmental conditions of a site. And we also provide what are called targeted brownfield assessments. And state environmental agencies are also a good resource for that. And if you have any eligibility questions regarding a specific site, we encourage you to reach out to your regional EPA brownfields coordinator. And a list of those contacts is available on the EPA Brownfields website. And there were two questions that I wanted to refer to the Vida Nova team. The first one was, are there any palpable trends in types of developments resulting from the pandemic?
I'll start with answering that particular one. Certainly the largest trend, and I think that we've all seen it, is the online purchasing trend for all kinds of goods, right? Amazon and other types of companies, buying online just became a huge part of the marketplace. And that's going to change the dynamic. How much, we really don't know yet, because while more and more people have become comfortable with ordering online, whether it be their groceries or their paper products or their electronics, whatever they need, while people have become more and more comfortable with that, they also truly are missing that experience of being out in the community and being out in the malls and in the stores. So there's a lot of pent up window shopping, if you will. And there's a lot of question within the real estate community as to whether or not that will translate into actual buying at a brick and mortar store in the future as things ease up. But certainly the need not only for the large distribution centers, but there's what they call the last mile distribution center. And that is where there's a smaller warehouse that is closer to either retail enterprises that don't want to have a lot of inventory in their stores, that will take deliveries once or twice a week rather than, you know, once or twice a quarter, which used to be the way it is. That last mile warehouse services those, but they're also starting to serve individual neighborhoods from a delivery standpoint as the amount of ordering online just grew astronomically and the industry needed to respond to that. What we saw over the last year to year and a half was that communities made temporary adjustments to some of their land use plans to allow for outdoor eating at restaurants and different types of accommodations so that people could be outdoors more. But we also saw that there were accommodations that allowed for different properties that normally wouldn't be allowed to be these warehouses are temporarily being used for warehousing type operations. The question becomes, will that be long-term or not? And I don't have that answer for you yet, but I don't think that this online shopping is going away. The question is, how much does that take over from the brick and mortar in a permanent setting?
Great, thank you. We do have one more question. Do the criteria that you discussed also exist for green space, public spaces, or parks?
There's criteria certainly for financing for some of those things. Now, typically a developer won't come in necessarily to develop a green space per se, unless it is part of a bigger development. They have to find a way to pay for that green space. Now, if you're looking for more of a community development and how can that be done, I think you'll find the Meriden case study interesting, how they were able to get some green space as part of a broader brownfields program. But financing for some of those things, whether it be through other agencies, state agencies, federal agencies, or even nonprofits, because there is money out there from nonprofits, such as the Trust for Public Land and different other entities, have very specific criteria as to where they'll put money into. It might be based upon size. It might be based upon population in the area. It also might be based upon, quite frankly, what the flora and fauna and wildlife resources are that you're trying to protect, not protect as well as make it available for public uses.
Thank you. I'm going to squeeze in one more question. Are there any cities or local governments out there that host an online inventory of available properties, such as brownfield sites and any city-owned properties?
Definitely. Many cities and Meriden, Connecticut, which is our case study today, has its own website where it will list the five or six sites that they have available under their brownfields program. And so it doesn't drive, what's nice about it is it doesn't drive people to see all the sites that are available. That's in Connecticut, all the sites that are available in Connecticut. But on the other hand, you have to make sure that the developer is going to actually go to Meriden to see it. So not only did they have it on their own municipal website, that information is also on the State of Connecticut Economic Development website. And there's a regional website that is maintained by a more regional agency that also includes those sites. So they tried to cover their bases by having sites located and listed in multiple databases.
Great, thank you. So it looks like that covers the questions in the chat. So I think we can move on.
Great, so we're gonna turn it over to Patrick Rowe now, and he's gonna talk to you a little bit about how to reposition some properties.
Great. Yeah, thanks, Elaine. Appreciate that and appreciate everyone's attendance and all this great participation in the form of questions as well. So keep that coming. Excuse me. Yeah, so this next segment, we're really going to focus in on the approaches, the tools, the actions that you can take to remove barriers and facilitate the repositioning of a property. Next slide, please. So there's a lot going on this slide, but this is really a visualization of the framework that we use when we work with communities to help those communities reposition their brownfield sites. This comes from the Revitalization Ready Guide that was mentioned earlier. So that's not yet published, but I think we're pretty excited for it to be published. And I'll say a little bit more about that in a couple slides. The guide divides up the work into five steps or five sections and starts off in terms of understanding needs. So this is really kind of the start of the work, which is finding out what the community's goals and objectives are for a particular site, taking inventory of various sites, ensuring that the public engagement has occurred and what are the results of that public engagement. So it's really important to understand, first kind of understand, you know, what it is that you're trying to accomplish. From there, you'll begin the information collecting stage. And this is going to really inform, you know, all the next sequential steps. It's a really critical step, and it's one that we'll spend more time talking about today. So on the information side, it's obviously critically important to understand the environmental impacts and impairments, what the zoning allows and any sort of land use provisions via planning documents, whether there's adequate public infrastructure to the site, what the market will support. So you're gonna collect this information and distill this down into opportunities and constraints for that site. You'll take that information and begin to synthesize that information to a reuse plan or reuse vision. And that is certainly going to take account of risks and liabilities. Also, very commonly, will include viability or some sort of feasibility analysis component. Once you've evaluated that information, you'll start to define your path forward, and your path forward is going to need to account for the different risks of different reuse plans. We'll need to account for how you connect with investors and obtain financing for a proposal or project. Also would need to deal with the site investigation cleanup aspects of a project. Finally, kind of the last phase, of course, is the actual implementation. So it's making it happen. So it's leveraging resources, it's building the team that's gonna push that project forward, figuring out what the operational and management components look like from a, in a short and long term. And again, this information is all in much greater detail in the Revitalization Ready Guide. And so we'll continue to refer to that guide kind of throughout this presentation. But once that's published, I think we're really excited to get that in people's hands because it does a great job of you know, going into further details. Oh, next slide, please. So yeah, for the purpose of today's presentation, we felt like we really needed to narrow the field in terms of what we, you know, what the guide covers. And so we focused on, you know, a number of repositioning activities that we felt like were worthy of highlighting and that you know, our attendees can really kind of dial in on to facilitate the repositioning of a property. And just to clarify, when we say reposition of a property, what we're really talking about there is describing the steps that can be taken to better prepare a site for reuse or redevelopment. So some of those activities that we wanted to highlight, again, kind of hitting on a theme here, is to compile and clarify property data and facts. So really it really starts with understanding your site and, you know, what are those strengths, what are those weaknesses, what are the opportunities, what are the constraints. You're going to want to identify and improve some of the conditions that you find. Those can be building conditions. Maybe a chief concern is clearing the site. Maybe it's inadequate utilities or infrastructure. Maybe there's some challenges with its visibility. So to the extent that you can improve those, you'll want to do that again. But some of these characteristics can't be improved upon. And so that might take you into a different direction in terms of the type of use that you might select for a particular site. Another thing that we wanted to mention is ensuring that the land use regulations and the zoning code is a fit for what the community want to see there and what the market is willing to support. So, land use planning, planning provisions, zoning code tends to lag the market and perhaps even what the community wants to see. And so it's important that you visit those documents and ensure that they reflect, again, both what the community wants to see take place there, but also what I think would be supported for the market. So what's realistic? Clearly, characterizing and understanding environmental conditions is very critical. If you've got two sites with equal environmental impairments, it's maybe fairly obvious, but the developer who's looking at those two sites is certainly going to prefer the site that they understand, even if there are significant impairments. If they can, if they have experience in addressing those concerns and can understand the financial and timing ramifications of those concerns, they may very well be willing to tackle those issues, in order to get their project going on that site. Identifying and resolving legal entanglements, these can certainly be, there can be concerns in terms of ownership, title issues, easements, these kind of things. So as much of this stuff that you can resolve up front and make the site as ready as possible is really critical work. And then the last bullet point here is identifying funding sources. So many of the more challenging sites that we work on, there is going to be some sort of financial gap, and identifying the financial sources that can bridge that financing gap, and doing as much upfront work as possible to line up that financing will go a long way in encouraging a developer to take risk in a project at that location. Next slide, please. So yeah, I wanted to just say a few more things about our Revitalization Ready Guide. As I mentioned, this will be a great resource to go through all those steps I mentioned a couple slides back and get, much more detail on that. It's a fairly comprehensive guidebook. Another thing that I wanted to highlight here, though, is we've developed a number of worksheets that we think are will be really helpful as you do some of this, you know, site analysis, site investigation work, start preparing information about the site. It'll help you organize that. It'll prompt you for that information and help you organize that information in a similar way as a developer might assess the property. So we think that those will be a real valuable resource for you. And again, just real excited to get that out. So next slide, please.
Hey, Pat, real quick.
Yeah.
Anita asked if that was a reworking of a previous guide, et cetera. It does come from the prepared workbook, if you're familiar with that, which Region 1 developed. But we pulled the regulatory information into an appendix and focused on the redevelopment process. And that's where those worksheets come in. So it's really going to look very different, but it does come from an earlier version that was called the prepared workbook.
Great. Yeah, thanks for that clarification, Mike. Yeah, so our next slide here is about the due diligence process. I'm, you know, looking at who attended today's call. It seems like many are probably familiar with due diligence. And, you know, when it comes to the environmental due diligence, which is obviously very, very critical in terms of conducting all appropriate inquiry and you know, benefiting from CERCLA liability protections. But this is, you know, equally important to do on the real estate side of things as well, and identifying, you know, whether it's infrastructure challenges, easements, you know, misaligned zoning, or other, you know, property attributes or site attributes that, you know, could be challenges or, you know, could be something, could be absolute strengths that, you know, lead you to in a direction in terms of kind of reuse opportunities. Next slide, please. So another approach that we wanted to highlight, an approach, a tool, is a site reuse assessment. This is something that the EPA, this is a tool that the EPA can deploy. And, you know, many individuals I imagine on this call are maybe familiar to this, but I think it's a really important tool that focuses in on understanding and evaluating key attributes, again, strengths and weaknesses about a site. It looks at, you know, look at, you know, the site documentation that we've described, whether that's, survey information about the site, topographic, floodplain, et cetera, but also looking at the market and what might be supported there and really taking account of the environmental conditions. So this is a great tool in that it can, you know, this can, for one, I mean, if you identify, for example, if you're identifying an infrastructure challenge, that might point you into an infrastructure direction and can help you align the right funding and financial resources that you need to address those issues. This is absolutely great background information in supporting different grant applications. And finally, it's certainly a great tool in terms of providing information on the site and the opportunities to potential developers or investors who might consider looking at that property. Next slide, please. So that site reuse assessment is really, like much of this work is really distilling kind of a lot of the site information down to opportunities and constraints. And with the site reuse approach, it's categorizing those into four areas. So one, it's looking at opportunities and constraints on a site basis. So some of the examples here are really great. So the wetlands, floodplains, you know, what's the topography look like? What are the existing buildings there? Are there easements that are crisscrossing the property? Is there water? Is there water augmentation that's required for that particular site? Another category here is looking at opportunities and constraints on the environmental side of things, or the land use side of things. So land characteristics in terms of is the zoning appropriate for market conditions? Is it appropriate for what the community wants to see occur there? And then finally, kind of that last category is assessing the that trunk, I would call this trunk infrastructure, and whether there's adequacy of that, you know, whether that's, you know, access and roads, bridges, intersection improvements, utilities, those kind of things. Next slide, please. So this next sequence of slides, we're going to go through some of these common constraints by category and talk about those in just a little bit more detail. So on a site characteristic basis, alluded to these just a minute ago, but in terms of the property survey title or legal records, you know, really critical to get a handle on those. We see, you know, many cases where those can present issues. Title work is can be very critical to that. And even with great title work, you may not cover all your bases there. Involved with a project in an adjacent community to mine, and they just found a gas transmission line crossing the site, and found it actually in the process of moving dirt, which is definitely not the time where you want to find that gas line. And of course, this had big implications to the design. I think in this particular case, happened to be fairly fortunate where this line was, and so a fairly nominal, I guess, design modification, but a design modification nonetheless. So these are the things you want to avoid by doing this work up front, understanding kind of where those easements are. Are there long-term lease agreements in place? You know, what are the condition of buildings? What's the environmental abatement that needs to take place? Is there asbestos conditions that need to be mitigated? And again, what's that landscape look like? And if you see just the slide that we're showing here, it's highlighting just a little snippet from one of those worksheets that I mentioned. And again, we really tried to kind of develop these worksheets in a comprehensive way so that it's prompting you for a lot of this information, and to make at least the questions, you know, fairly obvious, and you can kind of go through the guide and it'll, help you collect that information. So next slide, please. So common constraints on the environmental side, you know, a big issue here is incomplete assessments. I mentioned this earlier, but the unknown piece here is a big liability for a site. Not knowing what's there is, you know, it's depending on the site, it can be very unlikely for a developer to want to move forward when they, you know, if the assessment piece is not known and it's, and, you know, suspected to be significant. There can be the timing and cost that can be associated on the environmental side can be so significant. It can certainly eliminate a site from consideration. And so really important to do that work up front and to the greatest extent possible, quantify both in terms of cost, but also timing and approach, how you deal with those environmental issues. Another challenge here can certainly be the environmental regulatory framework in terms of different agencies and maybe unclear kind of as to whose regulations will kind of supersede whose or how these agencies work together can be a challenge, but something that can easily be sorted out when you've got time and you approach this stuff on an upfront basis. Unclear and inflexible regulatory programs, again, can be an issue, but I would say with the benefit of time and, I think a lot of our experience is that people are really rooting for these sites and I think really want to help everyone out in terms of moving the ball forward. So if you can get in and start dealing with these issues early, I think you're in a much better position. So next slide, please. On the land use side of constraints, again, hitting on a theme here, you know, one of the things that we see is that sometimes the zoning code and some of the planning can be quite stale and may not reflect both the market reality, which, you know, there was a question in terms of, you know, how is the pandemic changing what gets built? And so some of the stuff can move really quickly. I mean, it's, you know, more quickly, certainly than the real estate and development community can respond, but certainly more quickly than, you know, more static, land use planning document or zoning code can respond. And so, In the context of looking at what it is that, you know, what the reuse options may be for a site, it's really important to, you know, to make sure that there is good planning and zoning support for those uses. You know, certainly if you have to do a zoning change, there can be, you know, again, another just really long period of time associated with the change like that. Could be, you know, a year, could be 2 years to deal with, you know, some significant, you know, a change in zoning or some other, you know, more significant entitlement issues. And so best to have those addressed up front and just make things as ready as possible. Zoning, overly prescriptive zoning can be a challenge. Again, it's just, you know, that just may not be in line with how quick and dynamic our market is changing. Also, it's important to look at the multiple layers of regulations and be clear that you're working with the appropriate jurisdictions. Next slide, please. The infrastructure side of things, you know, this may be a fairly obvious site consideration, site constraint, but this, you know, these tend to be big ticket items. And to the extent that it's, you know, we're talking about area infrastructure or trunk infrastructure, you know, the costs associated with these are massive, and they need to, you know, these are long range projects that need to be accounted for. So in some cases, it's about having an interim plan here and addressing that in a, you know, in an interim fashion. And then of course, having a long-term plan that's able to come to fruition as well. One thing to note here is that EPA, this is another area where EPA can really help. They can help with an infrastructure evaluation, where they can look at kind of those service issues and help, you know, help address those and pair those issues with perhaps additional funding as well. But utilities, of course, we're talking about sanitary, stormwater, water, electric, gas, communications. You know, this more and more, obviously, interconnectivity is critical. You know, certainly if you're looking at, you know, a data center type use, the, you know, fiber density and those kind of things are just incredibly important. I think we're good here. Next slide, please. So removing constraints, when we look at constraints, I really sort constraints into two buckets. I kind of see them as being either project or site constraints, and then also market constraints. Removing those constraints is certainly important. I mean, it can ensure that a deal gets done in a timely manner. So many of the constraints that we just you know, we're talking about had longer lead times associated with them. And that, you know, the timing on a development project can be very costly, particularly in smaller communities. I would submit that having a project, having a site that can be ready and is able to be used in an opportunistic fashion, can take advantage of current trends is really important. Because you know, by the time somebody takes an interest in a site and goes through, you know, the process of dealing with environmental infrastructure challenges, those things that do have those longer lead times, the real estate market may have changed over that period of time. And that really speaks to the risk that a developer is assessing. And so the faster they can bring a project to market and the kind of the more clear-eyed they can be about kind of what the challenges are and better understand kind of, you know, what that process looks like, the more likely they are to be willing to take on a site. Removing constraints can also open up different avenues for development. So if you can look at a higher and more intensive use if you resolve a zoning issue, for example. And you might open it up to additional developers. Again, you know, you might maybe a local developer who's kind of more in tune with local politics and process might be more willing to take on some of that risk. But a national developer or regional developer who's looking at a number of different sites, I think they're looking for the most predictable project. They want to see the most predictable project, the one that's going to be, that's going to deliver their financial underwriting expectations to their investors. And so, yeah, again, just hitting on readiness. Next slide, please. I'll go through this one quickly because I think we're, you know, we've hit on some of this already, but taking the legal and administrative actions. So again, that's, you know, making sure that you dig into the property, you compile kind of all the data and facts, use the worksheets that will be in the guide, ensure that the land use regulations are, you know, conform with what it is that you intend to do, that there's, you know, there's not conflict there. Resolve your title and legal entanglements, deal with that up front. You know, these are the type of issues that'll certainly cause a developer to steer clear of a site. And identify and promote those available funding sources. Next slide, please. So site assessment and remedial action. So again, the further along the site is in the investigation cleanup process, the more attractive it's going to be to developers. So do those, you know, conduct those phase one, phase two activities early. You know, make sure that you've get some baseline environmental information so that you can, you know, appropriately and adequately characterize a site so if there is a, you know, somebody who is looking at it, that they can understand those. You know, try to deal with some of those shorter term liabilities, and, you know, understand the O&M piece for those longer term liabilities. And you know, I guess last bullet point that there is, we're trying to say that, yeah, the more you can do in conducting those remedial actions, you know, it's going to add value to the property, and not just in the, you know, most obvious sense, but again, you know, as it relates to how many different types of developers might look at a project there. If there's a lot of hair on a project, you just might not get a very good look. So, next slide, please. So I think it's easy when a property has kind of this environmental narrative to not look beyond the environmental, but there are many other issues aside from environmental constraints that need to be addressed. And certainly those include, you know, flood control can be a very common one. You know, if it's in a, you know, floodplain or flood fringe area, you need to make sure that you're, you know, addressing kind of those federal and local requirements, dealing with outmoded or derelict buildings, you know, whether that's somehow, finding a way to rehabilitate and reutilize those buildings, or if it's beyond that point, then deconstructing and you know, clearing the site and leaving it in a kind of clean and clear condition. Obviously investing in transit options can create new market opportunities, you know, certainly, you know, residential, retail, primary employment, you know, want to be located, or along transit, securing and renewing those permits that can attract end users, is also something that, you know, shouldn't be overlooked. And then finally, funding and grant opportunities exist for a multitude of different projects. You know, certainly, I guess in my experience, kind of those larger kind of, you know, like an infrastructure is a good example, you know, there can be more funding for it. Funding might be more difficult to get, it might take longer to deploy, but those kind of those bigger issues, there can be, you know, very significant federal and state funding opportunities for that. So next slide, please. Yeah, which brings us really into the role of federal stimulus packages. So, you know, federal incentives, federal funding is critical. I think the, you know, example that we have here on the slide is infrastructure investments. Infrastructure is a great example for this because it is that, you know, that kind of larger scale, you know, cost commitment that certainly a single development is not going to be able to bear. Many times, you know, even a larger area of development, depending on kind of the magnitude of the infrastructure challenge, may not be able to address. So it's, you know, it's important that the federal stimulus and federal, you know, funds are utilized for those type of projects. And, you know, there certainly is availability in funds. So there's, you know, there's, you know, the common kind of CDBG funds that can be used at a local level. And there can be, you know, very significant, you know, flexibility around there. There's also there are many loan and grant opportunities for different infrastructure projects. There's also the American Rescue Plan dollars, which have been, which are still available. So some of those COVID relief funds that are available. I think that's all I'll say on this for now, but happy to answer any questions. Let's do our final slide just in interest of time. Value of local incentives. So I think the message that we wanted to get across here is that local incentives are also really critical for many of these sites. For one, they can offer more flexibility. So they're obviously federal programs are designed at a federal level, and they're fairly targeted in many cases, and as they should be. But you know, one challenge of having very targeted programs is that it may not be the right match for your project, and local funds can offer much more flexibility in their application, from types of projects to even the timing that they can be deployed. They're excellent, kind of to hit on this next point, in terms of leverage. So they can be used as that, you know, the quote unquote local match in order to leverage other funding sources, including federal funds. And then final point on local incentives is just underscore their significance. I think, you know, there might be a tendency to think that local incentives aren't very significant, but when you look at the financing capabilities of, you know, of local taxes, essentially. And so, you know, tax increment financing, tax abatements, you know, just the various programs that utilize those revenues, or adding additional taxes as more commonly occurs in Colorado in the form of metro districts. This can be really significant in scale financing, you know, tens of millions of dollars, you know, can be what you're talking about for sure. So wanted to just underscore that significance as well. I believe that's our last slide. So would love to open it up to any questions that you guys have.
Yeah, it looks like there were a few questions. The first one is about community engagement. At what point in the redevelopment process should community engagement begin, and how?
So I come from certainly, you know, more of a planning orientation. So I kind of feel like that community engagement should constantly be occurring, and hopefully has occurred before you even, you know, touched kind of before you even thought about a redevelopment. But I also think it's, you know, it can be really important in the context of, you know, particularly if that site is under public ownership. I think it's really important to reach out to the community and understand kind of what, you know, what it is that the community wants to see take place with that site. So I guess my answer is that I'm hoping that community engagement is kind of is a continuous process that is happening and associated kind of on regular intervals for planning purposes, but also, you know, in the context of a redevelopment, you know, would love to see that at the very front end when, you know, as part of a kind of a visioning process.
Yeah, I did want to add to that. So it does depend a little bit on your goals for the site. Elaine is going to talk about Meriden, where they had an ongoing blight and brownfields committee. So as brownfields came up, that committee was aware, and you know, ideas were discussed. At certain points, they went out and did other things based on that. But it's a little bit about, you know, what are your goals? Is there a community that would be impacted by a site? So an industrial area, there may not be significant community to engage. But yeah, it's always important that to the extent that you can settle the general framework of uses ahead of a developer coming to town, that just helps get the ball rolling and hopefully limits, you know, conflicts and that sort of thing. So you have to look at the site and the area a little bit individually and then cater that community engagement based on the amount of impact or the amount of opportunity for the community, et cetera. We could go on all day about all that. But yeah, Pat, yeah, I agree with you.
Great, thank you. I do want to squeeze in one more question. This is directed towards Elaine. What are some examples of permits that attract end users?
Well, thank you. Certainly, there's a couple of different permits that attract end users, and a lot of it has to do with where you're located. So first off, water draw permits are of significant value in certain parts of the country and for certain uses. So if it's an industrial site that you want to have as much opportunity to attract an industrial end user, some of those permits to be able to draw water, whether it be from a significant river source or whatnot, is critically important. Also, going on that water theme, if you have a property that has an old dock or an old seawall alongside of it, we've worked on properties on the Delaware River and on Long Island Sound and out in California, the fact that the foundations of that old wall may be there, may be your grandfathering for some of those permits. So you don't want to necessarily take those things down if they can help you with grandfathering. So when you do your constraints analysis, when you look at your sites, you want to ask all of those questions. And there may be other things in terms of air permits that are transferable for industrial purposes as well. So certainly the industrial permits are key. A lot of other permits in terms of development and whatnot, it's all development specific, so you might have to reapply.
Great. Thank you, Elaine. Looks like that covers the Q&A, so we can move on to the next portion.
Great. Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about the city of Meriden. And what I'm going to try and do with this presentation here is walk you through this case study that I think demonstrates what Patrick was trying to teach you in terms of how understanding what your constraints are and putting together a long-term view of a package of how you can address those constraints can go a long way to creating interest and opportunity for your community. Next slide. So Meriden, Connecticut, small city in Connecticut, took two-decade-long brownfields program. They started out by doing a brownfields inventory, and over the course of 10, 15 years, applied for EPA funding every single year. Some years they applied for assessment funding, some years they applied for inventory and cleanup funding, and then they also applied for state funding. So it was a very long-term, long view of how to address their brownfields issues. But they looked at it from the start at looking at this inventory and then leveraged other resources within the city. Next. So let's talk a little bit about the constraints and challenges that this city faced. They had done a number of city planning studies and reuse assessments and identified a number of challenges and constraints that were beyond just the environmental. And that's what we mean about understanding what the constraints might be. First off, there were numerous brownfields properties that required site investigation and cleanup. And I saw one of the questions was, you know, site site assessments only have a certain shelf life. Why you want to do that? Well, even if the site assessment is old, it's still a starting place for developers to understand what the site challenges might be. They may have to redo their own site assessment in order to do their own due diligence and all appropriate inquiry, but it's a starting place. But in addition to the brownfields that they had several abandoned and derelict former industrial sites concentrated in the center of the city that presented trespassing and safety hazards. They had poor access from the major highways. So while this was a small size city in Connecticut, when they put the highway through, they didn't have a really great way to get to the downtown. It was very convoluted. The traffic patterns didn't make a whole lot of sense. There was a significant flooding issue in the town due to Harbor Brook and some other brooks within the town. But specifically in the downtown, one of the brownfields was built on top of the actual Harbor Brook channel. It was enclosed and the building was put on top of that. And that over the course of time, flooded on a regular basis. It was a huge problem for downtown. And so in 1995, the city created their Flood Control Implementation Committee, which worked hand in hand with their Brownfields Committee. And the last challenge that they had was limited housing options and concentration of distressed housing in the downtown, which really constrained their economic growth. So how did they deal with all of this? How did they look at it? Next slide. They started with their blight and brownfields approach. Their history goes back to the 1800s. They were known as the Silver City due to their lucrative silver plating industry. But there was a lot of brownfields left over by the 1980s. Manufacturing decline. They have a lot of issues to deal with and a lot of obsolete and empty manufacturing buildings throughout the city. Next. So the city made a commitment to brownfields revitalization. They had empty manufacturing sites with unknown environmental conditions. And starting in 2002, the city formed the Blight and Brownfields Committee. That was one of their first things that they did. So that's an example of when they started their community outreach portion. They obtained funding for inventory and prioritization of the 13 initial sites. And they kept year after year after year applying for more funding and adding sites. It was a 20-year investment for their Brownfields Revitalization Program. Next. They knew that abandoned buildings were a deterrent, but they also knew that there were limits for EPA funding for things like asbestos and lead-based paint and all of that. In terms of the funding that was available. So they looked for other resources and they did asbestos and lead paint and hazardous building material assessments using state funding as well as funding from CBDG Section 108 loans. And then they used EPA funding for the assessment grants. But they were able to identify what was there and demolish those buildings that were obsolete and had no value going forward. They were focusing on preparing the sites to be development ready. Next. They knew that access to the brownfield sites were difficult. So even if they got these cleaned up, are they going to get a developer to come in to this city when there's not great traffic counts around there? It's hard to get to the downtown. You can't even find it from the highway. How are we going to do this? Well, the city leveraged their brownfields efforts to attract other funding, state and federal funding, for vehicular and pedestrian transportation improvements. So they added pedestrian and bicycle networks. They improved circulation downtown. They changed some one-way streets to two-way. They made others a better circulation pattern. They improved parking and created a boulevard from the highway to the downtown that was their gateway, if you will, to the city. And then they added wayfinding signage so people could easily find their way downtown from the highway. Next. And what they created was this Pratt Street Boulevard gateway, which changed the whole dynamic for the transportation and traffic patterns for the city. And it's just a great, as I said, gateway to the downtown. Next. So they also had a train station in town that had existing Amtrak service, but it really wasn't maximized. It really didn't contribute to the economic vitality. Amtrak is expensive as compared to some of the more commuter-oriented train service. And so they wanted to create some interest in the downtown. The state of Connecticut had a new program where they were building, expanding commuter rail service from New Haven, Connecticut up to Springfield, Massachusetts. Meriden is almost the halfway point, a little bit further south than half. But they worked with the state and capitalized on that plan to expand rail service by to include the commuter rail. And they now have a new transit-oriented district around that train station. That includes mixed use and other programs, and that train station became a part of their rail improvement program and their downtown improvement program. And the important thing here is that it allowed them access to funding that was only available because of the rail portion. So it's leveraging other resources. It's not just about EPA resources, but other resources that are available by thinking a little bit bigger than just brownfields. Next. As I mentioned, flooding was a huge problem for this downtown. The historic and ongoing flooding of Harbor Brook was a major constraint and a major expense for building owners and developers. A big part of it was the need for flood insurance. So over the course of a very long period of time, the city obtained state and federal funding for a $35 to $50 million comprehensive flood control plan. It was involved the Connecticut DEP, Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, the Army Corps of Engineers, funding from FEMA, as well as the state of Connecticut. And it included bridge improvements and channel widening and property acquisition and detention areas. But one of the significant portions of this is that in cleaning up a brownfield, and I'll show you in a minute, in cleaning up a brownfield, it created the opportunity to open up the channel that was underneath the building downtown and create a flood control centerpiece, if you will, in the downtown. So using both EPA funding for the brownfields cleanup portion, as well as FEMA and state funding for the flood control portion, they now have a downtown attraction that is quite incredible. Next slide. So what they have is a centerpiece for their downtown community. This is what the downtown looks like on a nice, bright, sunny day where there hasn't been a lot of rain. But when a flood does occur and when it does come through, this whole area, including the amphitheater, floods, and it becomes your flood control bowl that holds the floodwaters from flooding other parts of the city. What it was able to do was to take some of the properties on the outskirts of this area out of the floodplain, because this became such a change in the whole flood control and flood system, if you will, in the floodway. But on top of that, it also became a destination. It's a great downtown centerpiece for concerts and activities and farmers markets, and people just come down to hang out there. When there was a recent flood here in Connecticut earlier this spring, people were kayaking in this area when it was flooded. So it's just really a great solution. And it also took care of several brownfields properties in the area. Next. One of the other constraints that they knew they were facing is the concentration of distressed and obsolete public housing that was downtown. So there were a couple of high-rise buildings you can see in the picture here, which was federal public housing buildings that were downtown, and it created just a challenge with the number of distressed buildings, but it also created a challenge with the economic vitality downtown, because many of these residents didn't have, you know, the economic position to be spending a lot of money, so you couldn't get retailers to invest in the downtown, etc. So the city worked with the Meriden Housing Authority to integrate their brownfields revitalization plans to create new mixed income housing. So rather than a concentration, it's now a mixture of economic residents in the downtown. There's affordable housing options. There's a beautiful new affordable housing options, as well as new market rate options. And all of this was built around the new intermodal center around the train station. So it also provided more job opportunities for these residents because the train station had commuter service to other locations in Connecticut. This new housing would be developed on properties that are now out of the flood zone, thanks to the flood control projects. And the former public housing was demolished. Next slide. And these are just two examples of the two mixed use properties. One opened in 2016, the other in 2018. Next. So there were a number of public subsidies and tax incentives required to do this whole program over the course of 20 years. And there's still some work that needs to be done. But just to give you a sense of the type of funding, there was multiple sources from HUD funding. There was Connecticut DOT pilot funding for their transportation. There was FEMA capital improvement program for infrastructure, low-income housing tax credits, state housing programs, opportunity zone designations, state and federal brownfields grants. And I think that's kind of the message we wanted to give you through what Patrick spoke about. And now as this example is that don't think of your brownfields program as just an EPA program. It's really an economic development program, and brownfields are just one part of the constraints that you have. And you need to think a little bit broader to remove those constraints, because even if Meriden had cleaned up all of those properties, until the flood control and the transportation and the traffic issues were resolved, there were still constraints that would keep developers from being interested in the downtown. Next. And that's really what the lessons from the Silver City were. Identifying redevelopment constraints is key to success and creating a long-term plan. It was really helpful that Meriden had consistent leadership and staff during this whole period. So that helped keep people focused on this plan that they had agreed to and started 20 years ago. Very positive relationships with the state of Connecticut as well as EPA. EPA was behind them every step of the way in getting this work done. And then by creating a signature destination that attracted visitors to the downtown, developers are very interested in being there and being part of the revitalization. Next. And so finally, this is kind of the quote that I got from the city manager, who said, little successes build to be big successes and then create the momentum that results in long-term revitalization. And that's really what they believe in Meriden. They needed to take each little challenge and resolve it. And it helped in the long-term revitalization. I have the information for Tim Kuhn, city manager for Meriden, up here. He's offered that if people were interested in talking with him, and we can make that available for all of you if anyone wants more information from him. And then on to the next. We'll open it to some questions.
It looks like there aren't any questions in the Q&A. Just a reminder, if anyone wants to ask any questions, please just direct them in the question and answer box.
All right, and I'll just step in here very quickly, Daniel. In case we have some participants who are new to Zoom, there are two ways you can type them into that Q&A box. And I think we might have enough time to take verbal questions. A few people I know have connected by phone. So if you would like to ask your question verbally, either through your computer microphone or on the phone lines, there are methods to raise your hand to indicate that you would like to ask a question out loud. For those of you in Zoom, you'll find a reactions button. It looks like a smiley face icon. And if you click that, there will be a raise hand feature there. For those of you in a browser version of Zoom, you might find it if you open the there should be a raise hand button at the very bottom middle of it. And then for those of you who are listening on the telephone lines, please remember that you can press *9 on your telephone and that will raise your hand on your phone number and we can call on you to unmute your phone line. And as I've provided those reminders, Daniel, it looks like some more written questions came into the Q&A. Did you want to take some of those now while we wait to see if any hands go up?
Yeah, and these are specific to the example that Elaine just went over. How many properties did the city need to take by eminent domain to create the flood control park?
I don't have the exact number, but they did take some by eminent domain and also through some of it was also tax foreclosure issues as well. But they actually had some very cooperative property owners who, you know, were very interested in contributing to all of this. Mike Taylor, yeah,
remember there was the there was sort of a retail mall in that was the main development in that area that had been flooded. And I think that mall had been owned by Meriden Economic Development Corporation. So it was a friendly sale because they realized that they couldn't operate a mall that flooded every 5 or 10 years. There were some other properties that they did have to take in different fashion, but most of it was, hey, we understand this place floods. We want to get it fixed. We want out of here. So.
Great. And this is one I can follow up on if you don't have the answer. Do you know if Meriden used a brownfield revolving loan fund grants?
I don't think so. I don't think they had one. We wrote a lot of the grants and it was mostly assessment cleanup. And then the state had a very robust Brownfields grant program as well.
Great. And this one goes back to some of the flooding issues that Elaine talked about. Can you provide any information on how EPA interacted with FEMA, how they coordinated with FEMA to address the flood issue?
It was really the city of Meriden that played the role of coordination. If you will, but certainly EPA was involved in many of the meetings or a number of you know, joint meetings of organizations. But some of the design work and whatnot was coordinated at the city level.
Thanks. And an Army Corps was brought in early. Right. So there's a lot of coordination with Army Corps on this.
Okay, next question is, what was the makeup of the Brownfield Committee in Meriden? Was it multidisciplinary?
Yeah, we had neighborhood representatives from the specific areas of the brownfields that we were focusing on, and we made sure we met at times, lunchtime, different times that they could meet. There were a number of representatives of businesses or business organizations. So the chamber was involved. The local bank was involved. And then there were a number of city entities that were involved. So city engineering, there was actually a blight activity. So if there was a property that where there was blight, there was a person in the planning department who ran that. He always attended. And then of course, economic development and brownfields always attended. City manager attended many of those meetings. And then other groups were engaged as we went along, and then certainly consultants. So there were environmental consultants who were working on things, they always attended. I'm trying to remember who else, but that's
Participation from the health department and the healthy communities group in town, in the city.
Right. Correct. And then various developers and brokers were also participating.
Great. Great, thank you. Another question about Meriden. Was there a one-to-one replacement of public housing units with affordable housing?
Mike, are you able to answer that?
I am not. We will get that answer. My sense is yes, because a significant amount of that housing was available for affordable. We are going to have the developer of the Penrose of the public housing units in our last webinar. And so folks will get to ask them a lot of questions. It was a lot of community engagement up front, a lot of interviewing and working with the folks who lived in those houses. So we'll get into a deep dive on how they were accommodated in the last webinar.
Great, thank you. Looks like this is more of a general question. In a small public organization, who usually takes the lead on brownfields? Is it real estate, planning, environmental? Who is it?
That's a good question. It can be, we like to see it in the economic development realm, because that reaches across planning, usually involves brownfields, can reach out to the health department, and certainly is connected to any real estate activities. I think the problem that organizations have where it gets pushed into an environmental function or a public health function is brownfields redevelopment is about moving those properties, and the economic development entity that has access to funding that deals with eminent domain or tax foreclosure, they're the ones that have that ability to pull that trigger. And so I find if it gets pushed down and it's solely a site assessment, health issue, there may be a lot of money spent, but not a lot gets done.
Great, thank you. And back to Meriden, how did the city build the public consensus necessary for such an ambitious redevelopment effort?
That occurred over 20 years with many. The Blight and Brownfields Committee met almost every quarter, but then there were many different types of outreach based on the decision that needed to occur. So for example, they had to buy a building back from a developer that wasn't doing anything with it. So you went to city council with that, right? There were decisions that had to be made about the flood zone and the design of that. There were large public meetings and workshops in the primary brownfield area. There was a charrette. We brought in Yale, who participated in that, brought in the community. It was on a Saturday all day. So there were many, many different meetings based on what was needed to get consensus to move forward. So lots of strategies were deployed based on the issue at hand. Elaine, you want to say anything else?
I think you covered a majority of it. We did a couple of charrettes. We did a couple of larger group programs, but it was definitely over the course of 20 years a consistent outreach program.
Yeah, and they would hold ribbon cuttings and public announcements and get EPA down, and it was just an ongoing effort to keep this in front of the public's eye.
Great, thank you. Another question about Meriden. How did Meriden's statutory disposition process factor into responding to developer inquiries about sites being offered through their list of available properties, if at all?
No, it did. So the city of Meriden was extremely aggressive in taking or buying back property. So the city, one of the key factors in the success was the city was not afraid to take ownership of properties and then disposition it. So, they usually addressed the private ownership issue up front.
Great. Thank you. I'm assuming this refers to Meriden as well. What types of environmental contamination were encountered on the redeveloped properties?
The environmental, it varied a little bit from site to site, but historically this was the Silver City, so it certainly metals were a big issue in this community, and there were some issues with volatile organic compounds as well.
Great. And the next question is, did Meriden seek out brownfield redevelopers or regular building developers?
Both. So yes. It depends on the property, but with regard to the residential properties that you see, those are typical, for the most part, typical vertical housing developers. There were many brownfield redevelopers who bought properties with more or less success. So we won't go down that rabbit hole today, but.
Great, thank you. And it looks like this is our last question. What were some of the strategies that the city used to engage and incentivize development partners to come to the table?
Elaine, you want to take that one?
There were a couple of different takes. I mean, first off, the fact that they had actually identified funding sources and working with the state, I think that that's one of the ways that they incentivize some of the developers is not putting it all on them to identify what funding sources might be available. And they did do competitive RFPs. So from that perspective, it also kind of created a little bit of a competition to attracting developers as well.
Yeah.
Mike, you want to add anything?
Yeah, so the state developed during this period a very well-funded brownfields program as well, and there were grants to the tune of $2 and $3 million that went to various projects. They did use tax increment financing. There was HUD funding. So the flooding, some of that was paid for through the Army Corps. So, a lot of different money came into Meriden. And, the Penrose developer, that was a HUD grant that allowed for the redevelopment of that property. And they'll talk about that when we meet again in November.
Great. Thanks, Mike. And it looks like that wraps up the Q&A portion of the presentation. So I think at this point, Mike, you're going to wrap things up, right?
Yeah. So we had those last two slides. So again, this is the first of three webinars. We'll be back October 15th. I did say in an email or an answer to a question that I hoped we would have the revitalization ready guide by then. In addition to that, someone asked me if the worksheets would be in Excel, and yes, they will. And you will be able to download them and use them. That's the idea. And then we will have a third webinar where we'll invite developers to tell their stories. We've got this one lined up. We're working on some others, but I assure you that you'll get the inside scoop of how they did it. And then we're very excited. You can go to the last slide. Is just part of Brownfields University. There'll be a, it's the first day. So if you, you know, if you haven't made your flight to Brownfields, make sure you get there for the first day, because this will be an interactive workshop. You will be playing a role. You will be dealing with a real site. There will be a lot of back and forth, buying and selling, negotiating, et cetera. This is not a classroom. It's going to be a lot of fun. And we hope everybody can make it. We certainly plan to be there. And the workshop is on day one. So come the evening of the 7th. That's it. Thank you all. Thanks for your time today.
Hey, thank you, guys. So yeah, on behalf of EPA, we'd like to thank you for joining us today. And at this point, Gene is just going to go over some reminders on how to access the recording and slides.
All right. Thank you so very much, Daniel. I'm going to go ahead and take over here on the screen and show our final closing reminders, and then we'll wrap things up for today. So the first thing that I wanted to be sure to do is just to remind everybody that they can visit the Cleanup Information Network website and sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, where we highlight and advertise free online training opportunities, such as today's webinar. So I encourage you to visit us there at Cluin and sign up for our monthly newsletter. I will also remind everybody that as part of today's session, and bear with me, I apologize for stepping away there for a second, we have already posted the presentation material. So if you'd like to download a copy, you'll find that on the seminar homepage. Remember, this is the same homepage we highlighted when you signed up. It's where you went to check in for the live event. So you can bookmark this and reference it from today forward. Again, downloading those materials from our presenters, as well as accessing a link to our feedback form where you can let us know what you thought of today's delivery. Now, one of the most common questions I personally get as a technical moderator is if we offer CEUs or PDHs. While we don't do that for our live online webinars, we can provide you with an individual participation certificate for each webinar that you attend if you need that for your own records. But you'll only get one of those if you fill out the participation feedback form. So make sure you visit that form. And when you're filling it out, check the box at the bottom to certify you are here for the entire live event. And as soon as you submit feedback, you'll have access to an individual certificate of participation for this individual webinar. The organizers and presenters highlighted a different certificate that will be available to those of you who complete all of the webinars and workshops related to this topic. That is a separate certificate that Mike was highlighting that can be a really great networking opportunity to show your education and interest in this area. So if you just need credit or just need the certificate for each individual webinar, you can get one of those certificates right from that feedback form after you submit it. So again, you'll find those resources available on the seminar homepage. They'll be available from today forward. The session was recorded, and we will automatically send you a link as soon as this archive session is available for on-demand replay from the Cluin website. We'll also include in that email links to the other two sessions that were advertised and talked about at the beginning, at the end of the webinar as well, so that you can join us for those. So with that, I want to thank all of the organizers, all of the presenters, all of our support staff, as well as all of the attendees who joined us live. We had well over 200 of you connect on a Friday afternoon for our first session in the series. It was really great to have you come on and share your questions and comments and interact with our live broadcast today. So with that, I'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. We hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time and that we'll see you connecting on a future webinar with us.